Hello and welcome to Aryan Esoterica. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and this is episode 1, where we will be covering Odin, the runes, Gnosticism, and prefigures for Christ. Before we start, I'll just explain what this series is going to be about. I've been asked a few times to produce something based on Miguel Serrano's Hitler, the Ultimate Avatar. I read the book some time back, and remember agreeing with a lot of it, and recognising where some of his information was likely to be coming from, but also disagreeing with some of the conclusions, and feeling like he was missing some essential parts of the jigsaw, due to some faulty premises that we will look at during this series. At first, I thought it would be a simple matter, to go back through the book, summarise it, and then give some of my thoughts on it, and get it done within one podcast. However, once I went back to the book, I realised that this would make a really good chance to expand on a lot of the subjects in it, and that to really do it the justice it deserved, it would need to be a series of podcasts, and it would need to be scripted so I could be sure of the accuracy of what I was saying. I read through the book once again, but this time I pulled out quotes or took notes to summarise what was being said, so that I could then later add my own thoughts to his. The book itself reads like a stream of consciousness, jumping around from one subject to the next, so the first thing I had to do once I had quotes from every section was to group them together into loosely associated subjects, and hopefully this will make it easier for people to understand, although it does mean that we may not be tackling subjects in the order that they appear in the book. If it seems like I am not going into a topic thoroughly enough in this first episode, and that may well be because it is extensively covered later on, so please be patient. In this first podcast, we will briefly summarise the views Serrano expressed, and then we will be looking at Odin, Gnosticism, the runes, and prefigures for Christ. In the second, we will look at Lucifer, the Black Sun, and the Green Thunderbolt. In the third, we will cover archetypes, avatars, and Hitler. In the fourth, we will be looking at the Jews, and in the fifth and final podcast, we will be looking at prehistory and the world before the flood. To begin with, we will start with a summary. Miguel Serrano was an esotericist who expanded on the ideas of Savitri Devi, looking at the symbols and ideology of National Socialism, and putting them into a framework based upon Hindu and Nordic pagan myth. A lot of it is probably right, such as the other races being mongrel men, sired by the original Aryans breeding with the aborigines of the lands that they conquered. He also seems correct to me in his analysis of the Jewish anti-soul, and why the Jew is the way that he is. He was also very insightful with the spiritual difference between us and the Jews, and he could see that they were the complete opposite of everything that we are. However, he does seem to have fallen for the lie that today's Jews are the descendants of the people who wrote the Old Testament, and this seems to have blinded him to references within Christianity that support his other views. He also seems to have fallen for the same lies that the Freemasons fall for, that secret gnosis is available to a select few, who can become like gods through their own willpower and the help of the god of this world. But this world is a world of illusion, and any gnosis offered within comes from the master of that illusion, not the God who created us. His belief is basically that of the old Gnostics, that because the world is imperfect, it must have been created by an imperfect God, who they called the Demiurge. They saw the real God as being a goddess called Sophia, who had been usurped by this Demiurge. So it was essentially feminism and equality being applied to religion, with the masculine being lowered and the feminine elevated, and it is no surprise to find that the people behind this were Alexandrian Jews. Gnosticism was an early heresy that they introduced in their efforts to subvert and confuse the early church. I used to be fascinated by it myself, and I have all the texts from the 4th century that were found at Nag Hammadi. They promote blasphemy, feminism, equality, and race mixing, just like the Jews are still doing today. I used to think these writings were representative of the authentic Christianity, but I later discovered that all the books written claiming this either had Jewish authors or used the Talmud to back up their claims. These Gnostic heresies appeared over a century after Christ and were a deliberate attempt to subvert the early church. Irenaeus wrote an entire book debunking them in the 2nd century, but the temptation that we could become gods through secret knowledge has always been there, ever since the serpent first tempted Eve in the garden. It is the same temptation that is dangled before the Freemasons and the followers of Kabbalah to this day, the lure of enlightenment. This is the light of Lucifer. It is an illusory light because it is one that man, a corrupted being, can access. It leads to a confusion between good and evil, thinking that both depend on circumstance, when what is good is always good, and what is bad is always bad. Sharano saw Adolf Hitler as being an avatar, or a representation of divinity in human form. He was an archetype of the hero, and a modern way of viewing Gnosticism through psychology is to see the gods that they spoke of as being these archetypes. Jung was the first to popularize this idea, and he saw the hero archetype in Hitler when he met him, and a lot of Sharano's work revolves around analyzing Jung's thoughts on him. There have been saints throughout our history that had more than the average amount of divine spark within them, and Hitler was one of these men. He was not the god of all in a man's form, though, like the Christ was, and I am not sure Sharano is actually saying this. He saw Hitler as being Vishnu, incarnated as a human, as one of the many avatars of this deity that are written about in the Aryan Hindu scriptures. Kalki is supposed to be the last form of the Vishnu avatar, though, riding on a white horse with sword held aloft, which is the same image given to Christ in the Book of Revelation, and also to Odin at Ragnarok. Interestingly, Christ on the white horse is said to have many crowns or diadems. These could be representative of titles, and could be referring to these other names that the horse rider at the end of time is known by. To me, this says that white people are hardwired to have a connection to the infinite. We know at some level of our consciousness everything that is going to happen, and this manifests in the minds of certain people, and they write down their impression of it. So whether you think of him as Christ, Odin, or Kalki, it is really the same being, and what is seen is a racial memory of a future event. I do want to stress, though, that he is not also Lucifer, which is one of the mistakes that Sharano makes that we will be getting into later, and I will state clearly why this could not be so. All the ancient religions have similarities, and this is because they all originated with white people. The same event, seen by different people at different times, is always going to be recorded slightly differently, and by the nature of Chinese whispers, these records would evolve into different forms, but still retain the same essential symbols. So we have Indra, with his cloud, his rain, his rainbow, and his racial purity laws. And we also have Yahweh, with the same. This is not because the ancient Israelites plagiarized the Hindu Aryans' Vedas, but because their myths both originally came from the same source. The Hebrews had angels or divine messengers walking the earth among men, and appearing as men in their records, and the Aryan Hindus had gods walking the earth and appearing as men in theirs. The problem with the ancient Aryan religions is that the Aryan Hindu scriptures have been in the hands of brown people for at least the last 1,000 years. The religion of the ancient Egyptians has been dead for 3,000 years, and the Nordic religions stopped being followed over 1,000 years ago. The only religious texts which we know for certain have not been corrupted are the ones which are still held within the white man's hands, are still a part of a living faith, the Christian scriptures, and even then, we have problems with translations being tampered with for political correctness or at the instigation of the Jews. the only authentic living religion left standing at the time of Ragnarok and the end of the Kali Yuga, is the Christian one. Our age is now so corrupt that even the gods have fallen to temptation, and when we read about them, we can see that they do not behave like gods, they behave like men, with all the passions, desires, and susceptibility to temptation that man has. The only one left who is still perfect and pure is the one God, the God who is with us from Alpha to Omega. The earliest records we have of religious belief in Egypt show a belief in one God. The Druids believed in one God, and believe it or not, the Hindus actually claim to only believe in one God, but with a multiplicity of forms. This idea can also be seen in the early biblical references to the Elohim, which was also one God, but with a plurality of forms. It is the idea of the host of heaven being gods in their own right, which is the new idea, not monotheism. We only have one Father, and it stands to reason that we also only have one God. Adding a goddess is to introduce feminism and modern ideas of equality into the equation. A god who is the prime mover behind all things has no need for a goddess. So if God is all good and all perfect, then where does evil come from? My own idea on this is that evil came from the void that was left behind when God took form. Like when you cut a shape out from a piece of paper, the hole left behind has the same shape, but is entirely devoid of the content. This void would be God-shaped, but it would be all that God is not. It would be evil, and it would be able to influence the perfect world that God created. Its goal would be to corrupt and destroy that world, which would be done through destroying the pinnacle of the creation, man, who was made in the image of God. This is exactly what we have seen happen, and it is what the Bible tells us happened, that the sons of God took wives of the daughters of men and created bastards. This is the point that Shirano's work coincides with biblical teaching. He sees the other races as animal men, bred by the sons of the gods having intercourse with the animals on earth. He cites myths to confirm this, and it is also written about in the biblical Apocrypha. The Jew is the leader of these mud races against us, but unlike the other mongrels, when the Jew interbreeds, he does not cease to be a Jew, and the Jewish traits remain in the Mishling. He does not lose his IQ, and Shirano sees this as proof of the Jew being the devil's own anti-race. Of course, he calls the devil the Demiurge to fit in with the Gnostic explanation, and he thinks that the Demiurge is Yahweh, which is exactly what the Jews who came up with the concept wanted us to think. I will go into more of all this as I go on. As we look at quotes from his book, I want to just give a brief outline of his worldview here before we start looking at the passages from it. One of the problems with doing this is that he did not include many references, so I have had to make informed guesses as to where his information came from, based on where I have seen it before. He starts by telling us that the Nordic god Odin is Wotan to the Germans. The name is interchangeable, but it means the same thing. The word Odin itself means All-Father, which is the title Christ says that we should use when addressing the God of all with our prayers, Our Father. There was a Scandinavian king called Odin, who lived around 200 AD, who had a son called Thor. He is mentioned in various family trees, including the one credited to Alfred the Great. It is not known for certain if the myths are pictorial and poetic retellings of his life, or of an Odin who lived before him, or of a supernatural being. Either way, he was eventually seen as a deity by our ancestors, and by calling him Father, we are acknowledging our divine origins. Odin supposedly hung himself on a tree for 9 nights until he received knowledge of the runes, which were given to him in a vision. This evokes images of Christ, crucified on a tree or cross, and to me, Odin is a prefigure for Christ. Christ's crucifixion was the most important point in our history. If it was a loud noise, it would have produced echoes through time and space, and I find this a helpful analogy for understanding what prefigures are. They are like a sound echoing backwards through time, and the various figures that are described as performing similar feats to Christ are the equivalent of these echoes, imperfect copies of that one original event. The early church fathers described it as the light of Christ shining through time and illuminating certain figures. Our myths and legends had similar things happen in them and used the same symbols because the real thing did happen at a specific point in time and on earth. They were like signposts pointing to the time that one of us would actually die and be resurrected, paving the way for the rest of us. One example of this would be Purusha in the Vedas and the Upanishads. Purusha is the first principle behind everything, the first manifestation of self, and he sacrifices himself to himself at the foundation of the world to create all beings and also to demonstrate the concept of sacrifice. The last part of the hymn to him in the Rig Veda says, "With the sacrifice, the gods sacrificed to the sacrifice." This sounds very much like it could be describing Christ, God sacrificing himself to himself. We then read in 1 Peter that Christ the sacrificial lamb was foreordained for sacrifice at the foundation of the world, but this did not physically happen in the world of action until 2,000 years ago. The sacrifice of Purusha took place in eternity, but it was not made manifest on earth until the time of Christ. We also have the legend of Ymir in the Norse sagas, who did the same, sacrificing himself to the gods in order to create the world. Purusha, Ymir, and Odin are thus all prefigures for Christ. They are the first examples we had of sacrifice, and it demonstrated to man that if he wanted to serve God, he should give something of his own up for his creator. This would usually be a clean animal, and we read in all the Aryan religions of animals being sacrificed to atone for sins, from the Hindus and the Levitical priests to the Norsemen and the Druids. Another form of sacrifice, but usually without bloodletting, is to do penance. Giving up food, alcohol, meat, sex, sleep, all sorts of endurance tests can be dedicated in sacrifice to the deity. Odin hung himself on the tree as a sacrifice to his creator, and he was rewarded for doing so with the inspiration for the alphabet. It did not come about through a committee, it came about through an individual giving up something of himself for God. Giving up sex is the most efficacious form of sacrifice, as it is the hardest thing to do without. But any form of endurance test can result in the spiritual intuition that resides in the blood. The difference between that and the path of the celibate is that the celibate is susceptible to this intuition at all times, whereas the endurance tester may receive a singular flash of inspiration as a reward. This is why celibates are found in all our religions, and Christ loved John more than the other disciples. He was a virgin who had taken a vow to remain continent for the rest of his life. Shirano thinks that the salvific rune that Odin found made possible the recovery of lost divinity by heroes. Perhaps what is meant here is that writing made it possible for us to transmit information down through the generations. Before then, it was limited to one lifetime, or could only be transmitted by word of mouth. But once we could write, we could record our histories and the time that the gods or angels walked the earth with man. By knowing how to read, we can read our holy books and we can learn that we are a race of heroes created by the Father in his own image and endowed with the spirit of truth, making us living souls with eternal life and apart from every other creature on earth due to this. The runes themselves are the form that some of our earliest writing took, and if you look at the examples of Paleo-Hebrew that we have, you will see that it is runes. The other types of white man used pictographs and cuneiform writing, but we used runes and words created from them. Most people think the concept of logos, or the word, originated with the Greeks, but the Ebleites, a people who lived in the same area that Abraham and his forebears lived, were using the concept 1,000 years before we learn of the Greeks discovering it. The Druids used runes, the Danes and Germanic peoples used runes, and the original Hebrews used runes. I do not think this is a coincidence, and once you get the idea out of your head that the Hebrews were the same as our modern Jews, it makes perfect sense that they would. Paleo-Hebrew became Phoenician, which is where we get the word phonetic from, and the Phoenician alphabet evolved into the Greek and Latin ones. Sanskrit is related to these alphabets, as they were all related, the same as all the races of white men were related, being all descended from the same first family originally. As the whites in the Middle East blended themselves with their Negro slaves, they became known as Arabs, which means mongrel race in Hebrew, and is derived from a word meaning to darken. The modern Hebrew and Arabic came from these mongrel peoples, and it is now known as Semitic, due to the Jews' claim to being Israelites. But the original alphabet of the Hebrew people was Indo-European, as we can see when we look at Paleo-Hebrew. We can also see from looking at the later Phoenician alphabet how close it is to our English one today. It is like a halfway point between runes and English, and we do find it engraved on stone markers in Britain, showing that this was one of the languages used by the ancient Britons, along with Ogham, which is closer in practice to the runes, being chiselled into stone or carved into wood. Shirano continues talking about runes. Quote, runes are symbols, extremely ancient mudras and mantras. Their origin is unknown. From them descend the Philistine script, Nordic Hyperborean tribe, from which, in turn, the Phoenician alphabet comes. So runes are older than the written word, corresponding to an inaudible Orphic Kabbalah of magic cosmic signs. According to Spanuth, the Phoenicians also descended from the Hyperboreans, already mixed when they appeared in historic times. However, as with everything concerning Nordic themes, the historic conspiracy makes them appear to be a North Italian alphabet of no great importance, invented in the 2nd or 3rd century of the Christian era. Close quote. The mudras he refers to are symbolic hand gestures that channel the flow of energy around the body and communicate certain concepts to those who understand them. The gesture that Pepe the Frog makes with his hand is one, and you also see them being used in many icons of the saints. In the same way that the runes can be created by hand gestures, they can also be made with the entire body, and Shirano recognized the shapes made as being a form of yoga, helping to transfer the subtle energy around the body and concentrating it in certain areas. He particularly noted how the Roman salute was based upon the Sieg rune, and from that discovered that the pranic energy, or vril, that flows through the body was also related to the concepts that the different runes conveyed. The Sieg rune body position, in particular, is very expressive of what it is doing, transferring the energy from the earth up through the body, concentrating it, and then sending it towards the object of the salute. Where he claims the Phoenicians were descended from the Hyperboreans, in the quote, but already mixed when they appeared, it would be better to say that at different times in history, the inhabitants of Phoenicia were different peoples. That area had many different tribes in it at different times, and it currently has Syrians and Lebanese there. Those people are definitely mixed, but you can tell they were originally white once. The area had mongrel Canaanite tribes in it at first, but they were driven out by Joshua. And when we first hear of a Phoenician empire that towered over the fledgling Greek and Roman ones, the area was filled with white people. They colonized the world from there, and we have found Phoenician inscriptions everywhere, from America to Britain. The proof that the runes existed centuries before the 2nd or 3rd centuries AD can easily be seen by looking at the word Yahweh in Paleo-Hebrew. But Shirano appears to have been ignorant of that and must have seen evidence of them elsewhere. Perhaps if he had seen it, he may have changed his view on the Hebrews being Jews, since he also believed that in order to use the runes, quote, your vibrations must be synchronized with the Aryan blood, in relation to its greater or lesser purity. Therefore, Jews cannot take possession of the runes. Their aura is hostile to the runes, and it would be devastating, fatal for them. In the esoteric Third Reich, the visible use of these very magical and sacred symbols was greatly restricted, and only very few runes were in use. Close quote. He is probably just talking poetically here, but it would be fun to see how uncomfortable it would make the Jews to be in the presence of the word Yahweh written in runes. Kind of like a double whammy for them, the word they are forbidden to write or say, and written in a language which is inherently hostile to them. I don't see how he can say the use of the runes was greatly restricted in National Socialist Germany, though, when the SS logo utilized them. All alphabets have occult meanings to the letters, not just the runes. Roman letters were also used for numbers, and even today's English alphabet has hidden meanings to the letters used. Shirano believed that using the runes could activate latent extranatural abilities in Aryans. Quote, through magic use of the runes of Wotan, the ancient Germans were able to recover a nerve bundle now lost, an inheritance of the white Aryan race alone. This nerve centre is not possessed by the black or yellow races, nor by any mixed race of colour. Contemporary physiology has discovered anatomical differences between the races with variations in their organs, but it is forbidden from disclosing these facts. Close quote. The largest organ of the body is the skin, and there is a massive difference between the white man's skin and that of the other races. It stands to reason that there would be differences in the other organs as well, especially the brain. The rate of hormones produced by blacks and whites differs also, and it is these neurotransmitters that are synthesized in the endocrine glands, corresponding to the chakras or energy centers that can be activated through yoga or other forms of penance. It is well within reason to believe there are differences in the glandular processes between the races that could give the Aryan superior potential or capabilities. We only have to look at dowsing to see one extra natural skill that blacks are incapable of. They still do not know how to find their own water and need us to do it for them. It is not an ability that they have ever had, and it is one that most of us have forgotten that we are capable of. It could well be that having the full use of our bodies in this corrupt age may be dangerous for us. We have less self-control now than we have ever had before, and emotion could take hold, causing all manner of damage in realms that we have little knowledge of in this era. Rather than thinking an extra nerve bundle is required for heightened perception, it seems far more likely to me that our endocrine glands would be responsible. Tests were done using DMT, a potent psychedelic that works by mimicking a theoretical neurotransmitter which stimulates the pineal gland to create more of the substance before then flooding the body with it, and the test subjects appeared to then see the different spirit worlds that combine to make our own. This drug can be isolated from various plants and even toads, and shamans in the Amazon take it regularly, claiming it enables them to converse with the nature deities. Rich hippies pay to go and sit with these witch doctors and drink the potion, which by all accounts is not physically pleasant. Uncontrollable puking is a side effect, and someone died from it last year. The Freemasons became interested in this drug and were able to sponsor legal experiments with it, which is a lesson in itself on how much power the Masons have, since the amount of research carried out on banned drugs in the last 50 years can be counted on one hand, due to the strictness of the laws surrounding them. However, when clinical tests were carried out, they were eventually abandoned, as the Buddhist benefactor of the experiment felt that using an exterior drug to stimulate these visions was wrong. He felt shame at gatecrashing the celestial reality. Perhaps these heightened states of mind were more easily accessible in the past, when we lived more virtuously and communication with the deities could take place. But as we have become ever more distant from our perfect beginning, the routes to get there become closed off to all but the most innocent of children. Drugs such as DMT, LSD, and psilocybin are all theoretically synthesizable by the body, but we no longer produce them naturally, and instead of questioning why that is, we force ourselves into these altered states of mind by taking versions of them produced elsewhere. They obviously mimic substances that our bodies are capable of producing for ourselves, but the point is that we no longer do this naturally, and there must be a reason for that. Chirano certainly believed that there were other routes to get to a visionary state of mind, but mainly through lucid dreaming. He was not talking about physically being somewhere else, though, like those who have taken DMT do. As his routes to a heightened state came about through following the Kabbalah and dabbling in magic, I would guess that this was the reason why his conclusions on the meaning and symbolism of what he saw could at times be so counterintuitive. Chirano continues on this subject. Quote, "Some students of this era, Professor von Senger among them, believed there is in Nordic man an additional nerve bundle enabling them to re-identify with the world of divinity. I would say, to escape and go beyond the archetypal world of the One, the Demiurge, Jehovah. This branch, or organ, is not found in coloured races and allows the Aryan to see reality in a divine projection and perspective. Hitler had total use of this capacity, only latent in the rest. This marks a fundamental difference between the races, helping us to understand the meaning of the intention to hybridize the white peoples, carried out today with growing intensity since 1945. The diabolical plan is to produce anew the monster of Neanderthal man." Close quote. Obviously, interbreeding between Aryans and non-Aryans would remove the capacity for any extra natural ability. We know that interbreeding reduces the IQ, along with a whole host of other negative effects. If the white man has an eternal soul, the only way to pass that on to his descendants would be to breed with another white woman. Breeding with a negress might cause a physical being to take form, but that being would not have the most essential part of what it means to be white, the ability to know your creator. How could it, when it has no creator? It was created by the creation itself. It did not come from outside of it, like the Aryan man did. While the white man loses out in the offspring by breeding with the negress, the black female gains. Up until recently, most negroes were of a fairly pure type, and they looked very different to us. The female, particularly. And you can check this for yourself by looking up the Hottentot Venus. This black female, with a huge elephantine rear, had 5-inch long external labia, that formed a tubular shape dangling between her legs. This was not unusual, and there were sightings of even larger appendages made in late 19th century Africa. Reports by the anthropologists of the day suggest that upon breeding with whites, the oversized external labia would disappear in the offspring, which is why we don't hear of it now. I am inclined to believe that this unsightly piece of biology may have been the original reason for Negro female genital mutilation. They say today that they perform this process not for religious reasons, but for cosmetic ones, and before they discovered breeding with whites would improve their looks, I can well believe them engaging in a custom like this, and then forgetting the original reason for it, since they had no written language. Blacks are an entirely different species to us, and this was far more apparent just a century ago than it is now, due to all the miscegenation since. To breed with another race is to commit the one sin that can never be forgiven, for it can never be rectified. You'll never get a thoroughbred back from a shire horse or a pedigree from mongrel, much less so when the species in question is of the highest order known to nature. Mud sharks and coal burners must realise what they are doing. A tiny part of them must know that what they are doing is hideously wrong, as the position and angle of the Negro's sex organs are different to those of the white man. The Negro buck's penis is erect at a 90-degree angle from the body, while the white man's is more like a 45-degree angle. The Negress sexual organs are positioned so as to naturally receive a black male at that same angle. The white man will not form a natural fit with a Negress, and somewhere amidst the heat of passion, there must be some recognition of this in the traitor, but like with so many things, we choose to ignore our intuition, thinking that just because something is possible, it must be intended for us to do. It is possible for sheep to breed with goats, and for lions to breed with tigers, but the resultant offspring is feeble and an abomination. It exists in a world of confusion, with a smell that is not its own, and the knowledge that it is supposed to be doing something, but never being quite sure of what that is. When experiments like this have been done with birds, they lose the ability to build integrity into their nests. They are no longer a part of their own species' collective unconsciousness, as they have no species of their own. How much worse must this be with the mongrel human? Serrano explains what the Aryan collective consciousness is here, and how it differs from that of the Jewish one. Quote, "The Aryan collective unconscious unites, seeks to complete, to conceive the unus mundus, the totality of the human being, deifying him. It is not exclusivist, nor manically monotheist, but pluralist and polytheistic. It lives and lets live. It is absolutely truthful and cannot lie. It tends to form an order and a cosmos. The concept of Jewish collective unconscious is always exclusive, takes the role of the part against the whole, fanatic, intolerant, proselytizing, dividing men, tending to produce chaos. Rosenberg said, the truth of the Jew is the organic lie. It hurls downwards, does not believe in transmutation. Materialist, atomist, it reduces men to subhuman conditions." Close quote. I agree that the Jew tries to produce chaos. He is an agent of the anti-logos, and he is the proselytizer, always seeking to recruit for his revolutions. Christ himself accused the Jews of proselytizing, and he said that every convert they made became twice the child of hell that they were. However, Serrano is wrong about the white man being pluralist, polytheistic, and not monotheist. The earliest religious texts we have of the Egyptians show that there was originally one creator god who was present in everything. The Hindu Aryans were the same, believing in one god with a plurality of forms, and even the Druids were monotheistic, believing in one god who had three forms. Why should an omnipotent god be limited to one form? We should not make assumptions about our ancestors, that they projected their own limitations upon the deity, like we do today. Where he says that the collective Aryan unconsciousness is absolutely truthful, cannot lie, and tends to form order and a cosmos, he is talking about the Logos, which is Christ, who is within us, the white race. That is what the Logos is, the inherent order behind everything. We express this order and our unique connection to it in our drive to civilize and to build functioning societies, and the Jew expresses his antichrist nature by doing everything he can to rebel against this order. We are constantly reaching higher to the divine, and the Jew is constantly encouraging us to debase and degrade ourselves, giving in to our animal instincts instead of intuitively resisting them and behaving like the children of God that we are. The Word of God is Christ, and the Word of God is truth itself. We do not have a verb to truth, like we do for lying. You can lie or be a liar, but you cannot truth or be a truther, because lying means to deviate from the norm, and to go against the natural order, to go against the default position, which for us is to speak the truth. We have the spirit of truth within us, and the testament of the 12 patriarchs links that spirit of truth with the ability to blush, something that Darwin called the most human of all traits. The word Adam, which gets translated as human in the English Bible, is exactly the same as the Hebrew word meaning to be able to blush or to show blood in the face. The white race is the only race who truly blushes with shame, and we are the only race who places a value in the concept of truth itself. Blacks have no respect for the truth. They cannot see any value to it if it does not benefit them to be speaking it. I realized this before I even became a nationalist, watching documentaries on blacks in Liberia and South Africa who would routinely lie to their friends in attempts to impress them. The idea that they were really just cheating themselves by lying would never occur to them because the spirit of truth is not within them. This should really be immediately apparent to everyone, because they clearly lack the ability to blush. Form follows function in nature, and if blacks were capable of feeling shame, then their form would be capable of expressing it. It is not just blacks either, but every non-white race that lacks this ability. The spirit of truth could never reside within a bastard, because the very essence of the bastard is a violation of the natural order, which is based upon truth itself. Bastards are a living lie. They are a walking deception that pretends to be a created being, when all they really are is an organic lie. It is not just the Jew that is like this, but all racial bastards. The Jew just takes it to another level. The Bible tells us that a bastard shall not enter the congregation of the Lord, not even unto the 10th generation. Common sense should tell us this really, that a violation of the natural order could never return to its creator because it has no creator. Bastards are the works of the devil. How else could evil enter a world that was pronounced all good, if not through the mingling of one kind with another, to create something entirely novel that exists outside the will of the creator? How could a creature like that ever exist in eternity? It would corrupt everything. Hence, the devil and all his works are here now with us in the world of mortals, and they will all be thrown in the lake of fire at the end of time. I have another great quote from Shirano to finish up with here, which shows that his line of thought was the same, even if he was unable to discern the same thread in Christian scripture. Quote, "Of course, the term collective unconscious is a term coined by Jung as a concession to contemporary scientism. Earlier, it was expressed differently, or, to say it better, it did not need to be explained. The truth will be better understood if we again refer to the memory of the blood, to racial sin, and to miscegenation between undesirable, incompatible elements. The mestizo, the bastard, as we have seen, hates the beautiful, is bitter with himself, intends to destroy others and to destroy himself, to divide and to lower. Furthermore, compensatory mechanisms make him exalt his own condition with lies, attempting to declare himself the chosen people of God, for which he must destroy the truly elect and their beauty." Close quote. The bastard will forever be the enemy of the true born. Thank you for listening. And God be with ye.
White system.